The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk, episode 492, to be broadcast on Wednesday, July 22nd, 2026, on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, lovely Dr. Fran Storch. She's off to work today, and I'm trying to catch up from the beginning of my week and the crazy weekend of bicycle racing that I was watching. Oh my goodness, we got a lot to talk about here today, so I'm going to move right on along and get you right into the show. This is Bicycle Talk. It's a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment, you want to contribute information to the show, and you're listening right now on Facebook Live where I'm recording this, then you can simply leave a comment down here below. I may or may not be able to get back to you. But if you want to reach out otherwise, then you can send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's rant of the week. Too many rants. Not enough time. That's what we got. That's it. No, that's not the rant. Okay, the rant is, get this one. The average car nowadays weighs nearly 4,400 pounds, which makes them less fuel efficient and more likely to kill or injure a cyclist or a pedestrian. And the extra weight does very little to protect those inside. If that weren't bad enough, some affluent drivers are actually paying hundreds to put pounds of bulletproof armor into their vehicles. We are in a weird world, folks. That's all I can tell you. I'm going to talk a little bit more about how much the average car weighs later in the show. But I got more rants. The UCI is at it again. Yes, they are. It's not the Sox this time. It's not the Ice Sox this time. No, it's the let's wake everybody up in the middle of the night and test them for doping. Oh, God. Who needs rest anyway? We're only riding, you know, 100, racing 100 and 120 miles a day. You don't need to rest. Anyway, that's a rant. We're going to keep going because I got another one. Yeah. The US DOT, thank you, Mr. Hump, has removed cycle road safety measures from their website. Yeah, we're going to talk about that too. I may have even talked about this earlier, but it's just disgusting, and it showed up in another one of my feeds through my bicycle industry feed, and it never stops. Fortunately, there's two things that are really, really good out there, and that is that the current administration is allowing the comedians free rein to pretty much have lots and lots and lots of material, as well as your good old friend Ron, Peddlin' Ron at Bicycle Talk. Yeah, lots of things to rant about these days. Anyway, on a positive side, the Tour de France. Yes, sirree, the Tour de France. What a week and what a weekend. Unbelievable what's going on in the Tour right now. If you are joining me now and you got to see this morning's time trial, you'll see even more unbelievable things. But we'll get into that a little bit later on. Excuse me, the pollens are heavy here today. So, other things that are positive. It's an important time of year. More people are in need of bicycles. I just talked to Mark yesterday, or 2 days ago, when I met him at our friend Saul's birthday party. Talk about that in a second. And yes, he is still in need for more bicycles for the WAME program. So, Wyndham Area Interfaith Ministries. Look them up online if you live locally to the Willimantic Stores Mansfield area or anywhere even close by that you could bring out any of your old bicycles that need a new home and will definitely find a good new owner. So anyway, please support WAME. We'll have more coming up. Yes, there is one more thing coming up. I have this friend. His name is Saul Nesselroth. I have known him since I moved into this area. How did I know him? Because he walked into the bicycle shop that I was working at when I first moved up here. And then from that point, he followed me down to my bicycle shop when I opened up my bicycle shop. I've known Saul forever. He's been a bike rider all of his life. And, or at least I'm assuming all of his life, all of his life that I know of. And it's, that goes back a number of years because I was in my early 20s or maybe not even 20 yet when I first met Saul. Well, on Sunday, the entire bike club, not the entire one, but a large number of people from our local bike club, the Thread City Cyclers, they all converged upon the Yukon Dairy Bar, which, by the way, if you live in this area or if you're ever visiting this area, college tours, you know, it happens. There's a place called the Yukon Dairy Bar, and they make their own ice cream, and it's really, really, really good. So we all went for an ice cream birthday party, and guess who paid for all the ice cream? Of course, Saul did. Why? Because it was his 99th birthday party. Yeah, and he did ride his bike there, and he did have a whole bunch of people riding with him to bring him up to the Dairy Bar. 99 years old, he's still riding his bike. There's hope. There's hope. I like that word, hope. It's a good thing. Anyway, what do I tell you at the end of the show all the time? Ride your bike. It really could save your life. I'm not kidding about this at all. So anyway, we had a little birthday party for Saul at the Yukon Dairy Bar. That was positive. That was a good thing. Moving on to the mechanical minute and bike tips. I got to pass this up this week. I got too much to talk about. There's all sorts of things going on right now. And so we're going to jump right into the content of the show. I'm going to work on the Tour de France later on in the show because I've got some other things that need to be addressed. Like, for instance, at the USDOT, bike lanes aren't just DEI. They're also unsafe. Taking a page from George Orwell, the government is now saying that bike lanes are unsafe and speed cameras are not proven to reduce crashes. In other words, freedom is slavery. Oh my God. This is from Streets Blog. I can't help but talk about things like this. So President Trump and the Federal Transportation Secretary, Sean Duffy, let's name names, have made it clear for more than 1 year that they object to bike lanes, automated enforcement cameras, and other proven safety measures, with Duffy going on so far as to say that bike lanes are just government DEI activism. Are they educated? Do they even know what's coming out of their mouths when they're talking about these things? But neither man went out of their way to say such safety measures were in fact unsafe until now. Yeah, that's why we're talking about it. Sometime between June 30th and July 16th, the Trump-run Federal Highway Administration changed its webpage of proven safety countermeasures to eliminate safety strategies that before President Trump's second term began, the agency had long supported, including protected bike lanes, speed cameras, and road diets. Mm-hmm. So, what does this mean? The administration had previously criticized road diets, the removal of lane traffic to make room for bike lanes and or pedestrian safety measures, or also to improve flow and with turning bays by claiming without evidence that they cause traffic congestion. You know what causes traffic congestion? Traffic. You know what causes traffic? Cars. Oh, man. Where do I go? This is absurd. Absolutely absurd. The agency has also canceled grants for projects that it deemed hostile to cars. Hostile to cars? You're driving around in a loaded weapon. Don't even get me started on hostility. But the changes to the webpage reflect the administration's new contention that safety measures are not merely annoying to drivers, but unsafe. Activists can't believe it. What do you think about that, huh? I can't believe it. I tend to be an activist when it comes to cycling. Bike lanes and road diets are still legitimate safety measures, says Ken McLeod, policy director at the League of American Bicyclists. Absolutely nothing has changed about the effectiveness of the data that led them to be placed on the proven safety countermeasures list in the first place. And until July, the FHWA certainly agreed. On the archive webpage, the agency said that protected bike lanes can mitigate or prevent interactions, conflicts, or crashes between bicyclists and motor vehicles, and create a network of safer roadways for bicycling. State and local agencies should consider installing bicycle lanes. That's what it used to say, right? That's not what it says anymore. Bicycle lanes align with the safe system approach principle of recognizing human vulnerability, where separating users in a space that can enhance safety for all road users, added the webpage, which ironically was illustrated with a protected bike lane in Washington, D.C. that the president sought to remove earlier this year. The agency said that creating separated bike lane to protect cyclists from car traffic reduces crashes up to, hang on tight, folks, are you seated? 53%. That's a big one. And on road diets, the at least until July, the site stated that they can improve safety, calm traffic, provide better mobility and access for all users, and enhance the overall quality of life. We don't want that in this administration. The agency said conversions of roadways from four lanes to two plus a turning bay also lead to the reduction of rear end and left turn crashes due to dedicated left turn lanes, reduced right angle crashes as side street motorists cross three versus four travel lanes, fewer lanes for pedestrians to cross, opportunity to install pedestrian refuge islands, bicycle lanes on street parking or transit stops, traffic calming, and more consistent speeds. More community-focused complete streets environment that better accommodates the needs of all road users. It promised a 19 to 47% reduction in crashes. I'm not just talking about bicycle and pedestrian crashes. I'm talking about car crashes here too. And on speed cameras, the agency's archived page, I might have to make a copy of this, put it up on the website, boasted that it can reduce crashes by 54%. New York City, which has the nation's largest speed and red light camera enforcement program, officials reported a 95% drop in speeding at locations with cameras, and that locations with cameras experienced 14% fewer injuries and fatalities compared to control corridors without cameras. But as of July 10th, those measures are no longer considered safe by the federal government. In a statement, an FHWA spokesperson did not address the Streets Blog's questions, that's why I'm getting this off of Streets Blog's site, about why the agency now considered its own safety countermeasures to be unsafe. The Federal Highway Administration is conducting an ongoing administrative review of its proven safety countermeasures to ensure that they align with U.S. DOT policies and administration's priorities, the statement read. The department is taking action to reverse the last administration's policies that decreased lane capacity and increased congestion. Drivers paying taxes with vehicle fees expect their dollars to be reinvested into our roads, not social initiatives that burden their commutes. Under Secretary Duffy, sorry, that was a hard sigh, the department is getting back to basics and putting safety first, the statement concluded. This is not safer. It's less safe, but the agency did not respond to the following follow-up question. We understand the administration's position on road capacity, but are bike lanes and road diets now considered unsafe? Clearly, bike lanes, road diets, and speed cameras are just as safe now as they were a month ago when they were promoted on the very same agency site, advocates said. Nothing has changed. No new evidence has emerged to indicate that separating the cyclists from motor vehicle traffic or slowing and better ordering motor traffic with fewer lanes are anything but tremendously successful street safety measures, said John Orcutt, a former top official with the New York City Department of Transportation under then Mayor Mike Bloomberg, a Republican, then Mayor Bill de Blasio, a Democrat. Their removal from FHWA's proven safety list is the latest step in Sean Duffy's intentional infusion of stupidity into the U.S. DOT policy. Ooh, that's good. Good writing here, Streets Blog. Love it. So, Orcutt concluded that Duffy's war on congestion pricing, which also ended up being a stunning safety and traffic reduction success. Orcutt added that FHWA's action could be harmful because there are many places in the country where the efficacy of bike lanes or road diets is contested, or state or city officials are still foot-dragging over them. So, we should be making decisions about safety based on evidence, says Stephanie Pollack, the former acting administrator of the FHWA under President Joe Biden. It's hard for me to understand how you could say putting safety first and then making arbitrary decisions about what it does and doesn't improve safety. You know, Sean Duffy, we talked about him when he first got put in this position, and boy, he has just been the talk of many, many bicycle shows like mine and also pedestrian-oriented shows that are out there. These people are clearly not paying attention, and they are clearly being influenced by the automobile and petrochemical industry. This is not good. Anyway, that's my rant and my show. No, it's more. There's more to the show than this, but I'll talk a little bit more about some of the other lovely things that have come up across the way. The Bicycle Retail and Industry News also had an article about USDOT removing road cycling safety measures from their website. So this is all over the news this week. It was also on NPR, so it's getting around. It's definitely getting around. It's just hard to understand why they would make moves like this. The logic behind putting bicycle lanes out. I'm just to get you some logic. If you are on that other side and you need an explanation, first of all, try to hit me with your car. I will slap your vehicle and then I'll explain it to you very carefully as you apologize to me for not understanding the truth. But anyway, that's another story, and it's something that I have done in the past, and my friends all are worried about me because I don't cut back on anything. Anyway, simple. More bikes on the road means less cars on the road. Is there any question you have about that first statement? Less cars on the road means less congestion and less people getting caught behind cars while trying to drive down the road. Are we clear yet? Okay. So bikes are good for the road, and they're good for decreasing congestion and reducing traffic and getting you to your work or your appointment or your dinner or your home in time. What about this doesn't make sense? Give us more space and you will be able to travel cleaner and faster and more efficiently. It's not rocket science, folks. It's just simple traffic management and traffic engineering. Whew, wow, boy, I'm going to run out of gas here if I keep up at this energy level right now. Okay, let's see what else we got here on the list. Oh, yeah. So in the midst of all this, there's all these little links that you can click on that are related to the article of which I was talking about. So what do I find? I find this lovely one about car weight. Okay, car weight. So Here's how much the average car weighs these days and why it matters. Why do I talk about this? First of all, let's just go off on a little tangent here and say why am I so concerned about car weights? Because even though as we get older, sometimes we gain a little more weight, okay, or some of us don't, depending on what your structure is in your body and all. But if you're riding your bike, you generally kind of stay about the same for the most part because you're exercising and you're taking care of yourself, and that's really good. This body hasn't changed a whole lot in about 40 years, maybe 50 years, maybe 60 years. Oh my God, how old am I? Anyway, I'm old. But the car sizes are just getting dramatically bigger. And when you take, and this is physics, okay? When you take this object, which is very, very large, and this other object, which is very, very small, and one collides with the other one, guess what the result is? The result is we have a problem. And the result is also a major problem when there is any kind of speed involved in this particular collision. So by reducing the weight of cars and reducing the size of cars and trucks, we can make our roads, hang on tight, folks, here comes the magic word, safer. Lots, lots safer. So I got this great little article here that says how much the average car weighs these days and why it matters, and here we go. Every generation of new cars seems to arrive with more of everything. Airbags, sound deadening, screens, even motors under the hood. Electrification alone has added hundreds of pounds of battery to vehicles that never used to carry one. I drive one of those, I'll admit it. While decades of safety mandates have piled on, reinforce structures and additional restraint systems. Automakers keep stacking up on tech too, from powered everything to bigger infotainment systems, and none of it is free in terms of mass. It all adds up and shows up on the scale. The average new car sold in the United States today weighs 4,354 pounds, according to the EPA's 2025 Automotive Trends Report, which covers the final data through the model year of 2024. The last two model years have essentially tied for the heaviest ever, 4,372 pounds in 2023, 4,354 in 2024, and there's still a preliminary count for the 2025, puts it even higher at 4,441 pounds. For scale, the EPA has been logging this number since 1975, when the average new vehicle weighed 4,060 pounds. 1975, let's go back in time here. I know I've got listeners that weren't even born in 1975. I understand that. I had been on the planet in 1975 for about 20 years at that point, because that was the year that I rode my bicycle across the country. That's why I remember that year so well. And the cars were enormous. Now, you remember your grandfather's Oldsmobile or your grandmother's Buick, the big Fords that were out there with the 400cc engines, the big Chevys with the massive, massive engines. Yeah, they weighed 4,000 pounds, and they got, 3 miles to the gallon. They were just horrible. That's an exaggeration. I'll give them credit. They got 12. But they were really, really heavy, and they were really, really unsafe in so many ways. Many of them didn't even have seat belts in them at that point. I think they might have just been starting to get into the whole seat belt craze at that point. No shoulder straps, just seat belts, and that's it. So that's where it was back in 75. And now we are heavier than those cars are now in 2026. A car carries at least four separate weight measurements. It's curb weight, it's gross vehicle weight, and it's gross vehicle weight rating and its payload. Clever suspension and quicker steering can disguise much of the mass, but they can't really defy the laws of physics. Here's what carrying all that weight actually means to how a car drives and feels, what it costs to run, and how it holds up when things go wrong. Okay, J.D. Power ties weight directly to survival odds. For every 1,000-pound drawback, the fatality rate is over 40%. The inverse holds at the pump, too. Losing 100 pounds is worth roughly 1 to 2% bump in fuel economy. Braking suffers as well. A car carrying more mass simply needs more room to come to a full stop because that extra mass has to be overcome by the brakes, no matter how good they are. Tires feel it too. Take the new BMW 4 Series. Its electric i4 eDrive 35 carries about 761 more pounds than its gas-only version. The 430i at 4,553 pounds versus 3,972 pounds. Roughly a 20% jump that comes almost entirely from a battery pack. And that kind of mass difference is one of the biggest reasons that EVs eat through tires faster than their gas counterparts. Weight doesn't just threaten people inside the car either. Once the vehicle crosses the fleet average of 4,000 pounds, an extra 500 pounds does almost nothing for the person driving it. The data shows that one fewer death per million registered vehicle years, but people they hit pay for it seven times over in the same measure. Trucks carry an especially steep penalty. Get hit by one and your odds of dying are nearly 200% higher than being hit by a car. Although that is an improvement from the roughly 250% gap seen in an earlier crash data, but it's still a brutal number. Buying an extra vehicle, heavy vehicle, doesn't add safety for the driver. It just adds risk for someone else on the road. Like I say, they're weapons. They are not vehicles. They are weapons. And they're really a big problem. Why performance cars are a problem? Oh, you don't even want to know. Not only are they heavy, but you also have lots of horsepower behind them, which makes them run into higher impact levels. And I'm not even going to go into the whole logic behind all this. Why do we need high-powered vehicles? That would be one question. If the speed limit is said speed limit, right, and the average person does not drive their car more than maybe 10 miles to get to work, why do we need a car that can go 170 miles an hour? I know, it's because we have very delicate and sensitive egos, and we can't handle the fact that our car isn't big enough for us. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Anyway, this is what's going on right now. Impacts are higher, vehicles are heavier. If you're not driving around in one of these big behemoths and you get hit by one, you're in trouble. If you're driving in one, you may have a little bit better chance of survival, but you're still stuck with this gigantic thing that can't get out of its own way and also is literally a loaded gun ready to fire. That's how we feel about it here in the bicycle world and the pedestrian world. Not real big on these guys. We're going to move on here because I got a lot to talk about here. We've had a lot of things going on. It all comes around this little bicycle ride that's happening over in Europe. Yeah, I know the World Cup kind of dominated everything and you didn't have to watch the World Cup, and it was very entertaining. There were a lot of good things that went on. But then there's this other spectator sport that happens to be one of the largest spectator sports in the world, primarily because as much as there was, I guess, free TV coverage. Is TV free anymore? And that's another really good question. If you're paying for cable and you're paying for everything else, it's not really free anymore. And it's the same over in Europe with the bicycle racing too. But people can walk out to the edge of the street and they can watch the bike race go by. And so because of that, the numbers of people that watch the Tour de France sometimes outnumber even World Cup soccer. Yeah. Every day, spectators get out they pack their bicycles up and their families, and they ride to a special spot along the road, and they've got their picnic with them, and they wait for the caravan to come through, and the caravan comes through, and all the advertisers throwing out all the free stuff, all the swag, you know, swag, right? So stuff we all get. So they're throwing out all the swag, and it's just a giant party. And all these people are standing on the side of the road watching it. So those are called spectators. That's why we have a large spectator sport. And anyway, and then comes the Peloton as it comes through, and it goes, whoop, and then they're gone. I know, it seems kind of crazy and anticlimactic, but unless you're on a criterium circuit and you see them go by each and every lap, that's what you got. But anyway, it's still exciting because you get to see all the team cars and you get to see your favorite stars on bicycles. You can practically touch them. Some people do. Not a good idea. Thank you. Please stay away from the riders. Let them just do their job. But anyway, it's the Tour de France. So here we go. We have a race leader, Tadej Pogačar, who is dominating this tour. No questions asked. He is very powerful this year, and he is very well trained, and he is I don't think anybody can stop him at this point. We're 2 weeks into the tour. He's got a 5-minute lead, or had a 5-minute lead. I think that changed over the last day, but I haven't got the actual final results. But there was a time trial today, and he did not win the time trial, surprisingly enough. But that's another story. Here's the other part of the story. The one person that was anywhere near catching him or competing with him on a head-to-head level, being as their VO2 maxes are 1 point apart from one another, they're both intense climbers and very competitive, was Jonas Vingegaard. Jonas Vingegaard, the Dane, is out. He had a very, very horrible bad crash on Saturday. He went down and snap goes the collarbone. He's done. That is one of the things that happens at the tour. That's why when people go, oh, looks like Todd is going to win the tour, you know, he's got it. And I said, anything can happen. And unfortunately, anything did happen, and it happened to Jonas Vingegaard. So there is now still there was a 4-minute gap. Now there is a 5-minute gap, and off we go and into the weekend. That crash was intense. Along comes Sunday, and we have Remco Evenepoel, who has an outstanding day on his road bike. And so he ended up grasping back a little bit of space. And so Remco is now in second place, and that looks really good because, and this is a spoiler alert, if you don't want to hear it, you don't have to hear it, but this morning's time trial, Remco won the time trial. And, knocked another 20 seconds or so off of Tadej, but he's still not close. Nobody's really, really close. So it's just, is it anyone's tour? Nah, I think it's Tadej's tour. I think he's going to get number 5. He wants number 5. He wants it really badly. There's lots of people asking questions. Oh my God, what's he doing? Oh, why is he so good? Well, he is so good because he has a physiological advantage over a lot of riders. There was a young man many years ago, back in the late 80s, who came into the scene, and he had just won the junior world championships, and then he was going on to being, moving into the pro world. He was from Nevada. His name was Greg LeMond. And Greg LeMond came into the scene, and everybody was like, who is this guy? Because he had the who is this guy magic. That magic is that Greg LeMond had a VO2 max of 93. And 93 is a really high number, and it means you can process oxygen better than most other people that are out there in the Peloton. And that makes a difference. It makes a real big difference because your engine is running cleaner and smoother. And you basically don't run out of air. because of it. So you're supplying more oxygen to the muscles, you're supplying more oxygen to your body in general, and the only thing that can possibly happen is that you fatigue your legs out. Now, in order to prevent you from fatiguing your legs out, all good cyclists know, what do? You don't push big gears, right? That's the word. That's the rule. It's the science behind cycling. You spin. You spin high RPMs. You turn your legs over at a very, very high rate and a high cadence. And therefore, you're testing and taxing the cardiovascular system. But when your cardiovascular system can't fail because you're able to process oxygen at such a high efficiency level, makes your legs last longer. Not rocket science, just science. And that's what we have going on here. So we've got two guys that are up in the lead. I haven't checked Remco's VO2 max yet. I'm sure it's way up there. But Tade and Jonas were both at 96 and 97 in that order. So that makes them machines on bikes. Machines on machines is the way I like to refer it when I'm talking about bicycle racers that are of the outstanding level. And these guys are truly outstanding. To put this into perspective, just so you know, I'm talking 90s, right? I'm talking Greg LeMond 90s. I'm talking about Pogacar 90s. I'm talking about Vingegaard 90s. Sepp Kuss, okay, who is an outstanding rider. He grew up in Durango, Colorado. He was processing oxygen at 8,000 feet his whole life. And of course, he has a fairly high VO2 max, 73. Wait a minute. 93 Greg LeMond, 73 Sepp Kuss. That's 20 points. That's a pretty big difference. And Sepp Kuss is no slouch on his bike. He is a very determined rider, a very strong rider, and he has promised to be domestique in all three tours this year. Right now, he is still in the Tour de France, and he did ride in the Giro. And he is going on to the Vuelta after this. A few years ago, the Peloton made the huge mistake of letting Sepp go in a breakaway, a standard procedure, by the way, of as you're going into mountains, you send one of your lieutenants, one of your domestiques, off into the mountains way ahead so that when your great GC rider comes and catches up because all the attacks occur and now they start reeling them back in, now you have a man in place to help you when the going gets real tough should they be with another competitor who is giving them some trouble. Now that you've caught your domestique and your domestique can go to work and really do what he has to do to project you across that finish line before the competitor. So that's the whole idea behind it, because they did this in the Vuelta a España and they sent Sepp out, and it finally looked like what was happening was there were going to be no attacks, and Sepp was out in front, and race radio said, it's your race if you want it. And he took it. And all of a sudden, now he is wearing the lead jersey. And with a big enough amount of time around him and a strong enough team around him to keep him there. And that's how Sepp won the Vuelta a España. It's, it turned into a team tactical thing, and it was something that he would have never, ever expected to win in his lifetime, and yet he did, with a lower VO2 max, only because he had such a lead that it was really hard to catch him, and he was still a very strong rider. But we go back to VO2 max, we go back to Tadej Pogačar, and this kid is just on fire right now. So, because he's on fire, the UCI, my famous, I love the UCI. They're just one of the most fair governing bodies out there that makes nothing but great decisions. Did you catch any of the sarcasm? Anyway, so the UCI has decided that there might be some doping going on. Remember doping? That you'd have to go back to that Armstrong character that, you know, doped his way into stardom, and also he was a probably a firm believer of Narcissism 101. He was just really just a crazy man. He was a mob boss. He's a strange dude. Hey, Lance, if you're listening to my podcast, I know you have one too. Then, you know what? I'm just calling it out as I see it. That's all. Yeah, you were phenomenal. You did great things for U.S. cycling until you did the worst thing at all of all for U.S. cycling. So, you know what? Take your hits as you will. I know you're worth millions of dollars and I'm nowhere near it. It doesn't really matter to me. You still cheated and that's what happened. And I don't have a warm and fuzzy feeling about that sort of thing. So anyway, call out. So here we go. Where did I go on that tangent? So the UCI is at it again. And this time it doesn't have to do with sock height, right, which we talked about. It doesn't have to do with ice socks, those manufactured things made out of tights and arm warmers that you can tuck down in the back of your jersey to keep the core temperature cold in your body that will help you from having any kind of a problem with overheating or heat stroke or anything like that. But oh no, they're aerodynamically more advantaged because they have a hump in their back. God help you if you have a hump in your back and it's genetic. Anyway, maybe you should be a bike racer. So there, my friends at the UCI are at it again. And here's what's going on. Vingegaard and Pogacar were having nighttime doping tests and they were authorized by a Paris judge. So the International Testing Agency petitioned for tests and the duo was tested outside of a normal 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. window. Why do they do 6 a.m. to 11 p.m.? So that the riders can ride their bikes and then the riders can go to sleep at night because, as we know, and I have talked about on this show endlessly, sleep is probably one of the most important things to physical exercise that you can get. And rest is rest is rest, and uninterrupted rest is very good for the athlete. Very, very good. So what's going on here? A Paris judge authorized nighttime doping tests of for Tadej Pogacar and his nearest rival, Jonas Vingegaard, in the early hours of Sunday morning. The Paris prosecutor's office confirmed on Monday that the International Testing Agency petitioned the Paris judge specializing in liberty and detention matters to authorize an anti-doping test that took place overnight between July 18th and 19th. Vingegaard and Pogacar were subjected to unexpected nocturnal doping controls outside of the normal window, 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., before stage 15, as the peloton headed into the Plateau de Salaison and the Sevillor Alps. Vingegaard was tested at 2 a.m. on Sunday by the ITA, while Pogacar's unexpected wake-up call came at 5 a.m. Pogacar described Vingegaard's 2 a.m. test as inhuman and suggested that it ruined his long-standing rival's sleep and could have been a factor in the crash on Sunday in which he broke his collarbone and forced him to quit the tour. Now that is a statement. I am starting to like Tadej Pogacar more and more. I'm starting to see things about him, some qualities about him that are really positive. Helping a teammate win a stage when he could have easily taken that stage. I saw him do that. I saw him do a few other things. He's changing. I think what's happening is he's maturing. His frontal lobe has developed. Yay, frontal lobe. Let's hear it for the male frontal lobe. And, you know, when you hit that, 25, 26-year-old age, things start to make a lot more sense. Like, maybe, just maybe, your parents aren't as stupid as you thought they were. Little things like that teenagers go through, and males especially go through up until that time of their life. So anyway, here's Pogacar calling out the wake-up call for dope testing as a possibility that may have caused the crash. Oh boy, that's strong words. Real good for that he had strong words, because what I like about that is that Bingo's been really, really outspoken about the UCI and the different things that they've been doing and how he has not been super happy with all of that. So this is good. This is good. Tade is kind of, you know, taking over in that position of advocacy for the riders. And the whole point is advocacy for the riders. That's what Jonas Vingegaard has been really a strong believer in. So the timing of the test was widely condemned by leading riders and team staff, including Remco Evenepoel, now who is second overall in the Tour, and also Vingegaard's teammate Matteo Jorgensen, and who said it showed a complete lack of respect towards the riders. The ITA said it was conscious that nighttime testing might be disruptive to riders' rest and recovery due to consideration it has therefore been given to minimize as much as possible the impact of testing activities have on riders. However, the ITA, on behalf of the UCI, has the responsibility to ensure the effectiveness of cycling anti-doping program and integrity of cycling races. It is now believed that up to 5 teams, including Pogačar's UAE team Emirates and XRG and Vingegaard's Visma Lisa bike, have been subject to nocturnal testing during this year's tour. While not specifying numbers, the ITA confirmed to The Guardian, this is a newspaper which is writing about this, that other teams have also been subjected to nighttime or early morning testing. UCI, wake up, please. Stop. This is madness. What are you going to find in the middle of the night that you're not going to find just before the race goes off? What are you going to find? You're not going to find anything. You're just, you know, I mean, it just makes no sense. If you test them early in the morning, you're probably going to find they have really high caffeine levels, you know, because they're drinking coffee to get themselves going. And then there's a rule on that, too, that you got to watch out for. So, you know, Jonathan Vaughters, now manager at EF Education Easy Post, currently riding in the Tour, and a former teammate to Lance Armstrong, who was stripped of 7 Tour wins for doping, supported the nocturnal tests. Vaughters, posting on X, said, 2 a.m. testing is one of the very effective ways to prevent peptide EPO, HGH, and testosterone microdosing. If the UCI had tested us at 2 In 2001 at 2 a.m., we would have all been suspended and saved the sport 25 years of drama. That is an interesting statement. So somehow they feel like they can see more in the middle of the night. I'd have to study the science of this, or have someone contribute some information to me that shows me what that reasoning is. I will copy this statement over and see what I can get out of it, because this intrigues me. That whole idea does intrigue me. So anyway, here we are. We're back on to the Tour again. It's a time trial day, and it is over with at this time as I am speaking, and there are more stages to come, and the Tour is not over yet. But it certainly has had a lot of things to talk about. So it's been interesting at best here. It's certainly that. One thing I have to also mention is that Leibowitz has also crashed out. He crashed out today in the time trial. So that's the end of his Tour de France 2. And he was way up there in the standings. So there we go. Also, he is a teammate of Remco Evenepoel. And that is going to be a factor, because when you lose teammates to crashing, then you don't have that help that you need. So it's highs and lows time, and the Pogačar did place second to Evenepoel's first place finish, you know, it's just a tough tour. They're always tough. I will say they are always tough. There is no way around this not being one of the most difficult sports in the world. He obliterated the stage 16 time trial. It wasn't even a super long time trial. It was 21 kilometers, so it wasn't that long, and yet he still punched into the line 28 seconds in front of Tadej Pogačar, who was second in the time trial. And so it was a big day today, and that will, I don't have the overall standings in front of me at this time, so I know that all I have is basically today's time trial standings, and that's it. The next closest rider to Tadej Pogačar was Mateusz Skrzymos of Lidl Trek, and he was a minute and 4 seconds down. So he was another 30 seconds off of Tadej Pogačar, and everybody else kind of fell in after that. Paul Cézas, the French phenom, the 19-year-old, was fourth today, and he was a minute and 16 down from Remco Evenepoel. Remco Evenepoel has been known to be one of the best time trialists in the world. He held the world champion jersey for a while. He's a spectacular rider. So I was kind of interested to see, because he won the stage the previous day, which would have been Sunday. He won that stage, and you know, I thought, whoa, maybe this guy's got a chance at it. Certainly making a shot at it, that's for sure. So Tour de France, that's it. I got to talk about local stuff now, and here we go with that, as I still have some time left here. So locally, I am going to go to my local club here, the Thread City Cyclists, and we have a bike tour coming up this weekend, and it takes place from somebody put that in the wrong spot. So anyway, this is Sunday, July 26th, and we have the Quiet Corner Bike Tour, and there is a number of different rides. They all start and end at Edward Garrison Park in Chaplin, Connecticut. If you're not from around this area and you have the chance to come into Connecticut to do a really nice bike ride where there are very few cars, I will say few cars. We still have cars and trucks, but we have a lot less than they do in other parts of the state. This is in the northeastern corner of the state, otherwise known by the tourism district as the Quiet Corner, Connecticut's Quiet Corner. We out here say, shh, don't tell anyone, except I have an addition to that. It's shh, don't tell anyone unless they ride a bicycle, and then come on in, check it out. You know, the water's fine. It's really, really fun here. So there is a 102-mile century ride, and it takes you through scenic areas like Devil's Hop Yard State Park, and then brings you up for an opportunity for ice cream at We Like It Ice Cream on the last rest stop. And then there's three other rest stops out there for you if you are looking for a little bit of additional food and energy, and maybe just to sit still for a minute because your legs are tired or whatever. So anyway, that is the 102-mile century. And if you go to the Thread City Cyclers website, just look them up, threadcitycyclers.com, not cyclists, cyclers.com. If you go to that website, you can find the tour flyer there. You can find even the routes that are on Ride with GPS, and you can download them into your computer for the weekend. Check it out. There's also a 64-mile ride, and it heads out the same way as the longer route does. But then once it gets out to a town called Colchester, it starts winding its way back down and returning back to Chaplin. And there'll be three rest stops on that that are also used on the longer routes. And the 64-mile guided ride starts at 8:45 a.m. Look at this, 102-mile guided ride starts at 8 a.m. So you can actually have someone who will help you along. The 40-mile ride is 41 miles, and it heads out to a rest stop in the Baltic where it joins the other routes on the return back. There's two rest stops on that with enough fuel to get you to the finish. The guided tour starts at 9 a.m., and the 20-mile ride is the shortest route heading out on the same roads as our longer rides, and it is an unguided, so it has, but it, there is a GPS for it, so you can get the actual route and download it into your computer or on your phone. And there's also an 18-mile gravel loop using about 8 miles of the airline trail with one rest stop, and there's a 34-mile gravel loop, which is... it's an option that will give you a rest stop at We Like It Ice Cream at 34-mile ride. The gravel ride starts at 8:30 a.m. So there's lots of support out there by our local bicycle club. And if you are in a local bicycle club and you're listening to this right now, I am going to do a shout out to you. First of all, if you have signed up, thanking you very much for signing up and helping us with this yearly event. Second of all, if you have not, could you please get a hold of Dave Wahlberger and tell him that you're available to help somewhere, because we're a little shy on help right now. That has been a problem with a lot of events that I have been involved with over the years recently. Last couple of years, it's been really, really hard to get volunteers. So if you're interested in volunteering, if you're coming from afar and maybe you're bringing a family member with you and they would like to help out, sure, we could use the help. We always need help. We'll never say no. So please, if you're coming in to ride on the Thread City Quiet Corner bike ride, then just give a little shout out to us and we will find something for you to do if you are not riding in the ride. Okay, what else do I have here? That's kind of it. We got the Tour de France. We're coming around the corner on the tour, getting closer and closer, and it's looking like it's going to be a week that is going to be dominated by the amazing Tadej Pogačar. Must be the new haircut. He's kind of shaved his head down pretty short, so he looks a little different this year. But maybe it's the haircut that gave him the better sensibility and the nicer behavior as a human being. Who knows? You never know what changes someone. But anyway, I've been very, very impressed with him. And, he won a lot of classics. He's explosively strong. It is truly amazing to watch him. And you know that if he goes really hard and can hold it for, let's say, 4 minutes or so, that's it. That race is over. He explodes, and then he settles into his rhythm and then just holds it. It's amazing. Anyway, we'll talk more about this next week because it will be over and we'll have gone into Paris and to the Champs-Élysées and the big finish and the big sprints and hopefully no more crashes, please. And we'll see what's going on there. So, give me your opinion here. Hey, the price of gas went up again because we seem to be causing all sorts of turmoil in the world. So therefore, we raise the price of gas because it's harder to get. And are you riding your bike yet? Are you even paying any attention to the fact that you can actually resolve this on your own, by yourself, and just ride your bike? Ride your bike. Don't give money to big oil. It's stupid. It doesn't make sense. All right, shouldn't have said stupid, sorry. It's not very thoughtful. Anyway, bicycling is freedom. Life is better when everyone and more people ride bikes. Cycling is an easier and safer option for more people because when more people ride bikes, people are happier, they're healthier, our communities are safer, and they're friendlier and our planet's greener. Together, we can all help spread the joy of cycling. I'm going to say it again. It won't be my last time. Get out, get active, get loud. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, the price of gas, and lack of places to safely ride, and do your part. And hey, take the Pedal and Run Challenge. Park your car or truck one day and just ride your bike instead. You will surprise yourself. And remember, whether you're riding your bike or you're driving your car, please be safe and kind. And remember that every person you pass has someone waiting for them at home. The views on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk with your friendly co-host, or your friendly host, Pedalin' Ron, without your friendly co-host. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, or now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. This is Pedalin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Get out!